Welcome to the Evolution Eats podcast. My name is Noah.
And I'm Emily, and we are here with Dr. Bill Schindler. He is a professor of anthropology at Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland, director of the Eastern Shore Food Lab, and he was a co-star on The Great Human Race on the National Geographic Channel. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
So if you could, let's have you do an introduction about sort of what is your overall background and then how you've sort of come into the food world and why food and the systems that bring food to our tables are very important to you and what your impact is on that.
Sure, I'd love to. I come at this idea of food and diet and health from, I think, a fairly unique and varied perspective. So my training is in prehistoric and experimental archaeology. So that means as a field archaeologist, I excavate sites that were created before the written record. And in different parts of the world, that means different time periods. So here in Eastern North America, it's before about 500 years ago. In other parts of the world, it could be before several thousand years ago. But the beginning date of those sites, the sites that I'm really interested in, really start millions of years ago. And I'm sure we'll get into that in a little while. But the thing that's, I think, fairly unique about my approach to it and how it relates to food and diet and health and just kind of the human experience in general is the aspect of my research that's called experimental archaeology. So experimental archaeology is a subfield of archaeology. And experimental archaeologists are trained in a number of different primitive skills. Things like reproduction of stone tools or ceramics or fibers or hide tanning or ways of hunting or trapping or all sorts of things. And what we do in the archaeological sense is we create and test hypotheses about the archaeological record. And this is an incredible way to understand the past. It's almost like a virtual time machine. So a good example would be I either might find in the field or somebody might bring me a bit of a broken stone tool that could be thousands of years old. And we have absolutely no idea how it was made or how it was used or how it functioned. And it would be my job to replicate the tool using the same materials and strategies and then run a number of different tests on it, see how well it functions in, say, butchering, for example. And we come out of such a study not only understanding much about that tool, but if we've done it right, we come out of that study knowing more about the archaeological record and how we can identify certain things, right? So I've been in that world for decades, right? I've been trained by a number of some of the best primitive technologists in the world, and experimental archaeologists, and it's been a major part of my life for so long. But how it relates to food is about 16 years ago when my daughter was first born, my wife came out to the garage where I was flint napping, I was banging rocks, it was probably getting pretty late in the day, and she said, "Hey, I need you to come inside." And I was like, "What do you mean come inside?" She's like, "I need you to come inside." I'm like, "Yeah, I'll be there in a minute, I just gotta finish this." She says, "No, no, I don't mean tonight, I mean you gotta bring your work into this house in some way. It's so important to you, you're so passionate about it, you have a family now, my daughter had just been born, and can you take that passion and that energy and that knowledge and do something that can benefit this family?" And I thought for a long time about how to do that, because of course she was right. Why do anything if it's not going to benefit the people around you that you love the most? And I realized that all of this time I've been spent dealing with the archaeological record and all of these technologies, I've realized that almost every single prehistoric technology had something to do with food. Getting food, processing food, storing food, redistributing food, sharing food. And, you know, when I really started to look at it through that lens, I realized how important technology was to creating our ancestral diets and by default, how important and how crucial our ancestral diets were in creating us as modern day humans, modern day Homo sapiens, both biologically and culturally. And that's when, you know, my entire track shifted to focus on just that.
So what most people may not know, and some of our listeners might, but this is to those that don't, basically, we are living in a very small shard of human history. And so when Bill talks about what ancient peoples were doing, this is most of existing human culture. We're talking about the 99.9% of essentially what modern humans were doing. This occurred before we ever started writing things down and keeping records and making paintings and all of this. There were millions of years of essentially human-like creatures doing this, and a lot of what their daily lives consisted of was food. It's pretty interesting. It's pretty clear.
Right, and what's also really interesting, I think, to remember, too, and that's a great point. So we're talking about 99.9% of us and our ancestors on this planet, the way we've dealt with food. And that's, I think, what we're going to spend most of our time talking about and how drastically different it is than today. But the other thing I think that may not be as evident as that, which is incredibly important, is everything that we're going to talk about today is a shared human experience. Every one of our ancestors did these things, and they did them really, really well. And if they didn't, we wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation because we'd be an extinct species, right? So, you know, in a world right now where we are so incredibly divided in politics and religion and all these other things, and even in the food world, you know, the things that we're talking about today are actually something that bind us all together, which is, I think, a pretty special, really cool thing.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons we're attracted to food as a topic. It's very universal. It's part of just a human experience that has always been there.
And it's shocking how much it's diversified itself. It's become something that everyone experiences a little bit differently, and there are already foods around the world that other cultures will refuse to share or will avidly share, and there are so many pieces of that which inform daily human activity. We talk about human culture. That is what people are doing on a daily basis. And if three times a day, or two times a day, however many times a day, one must consume food, then that's always going to be a fairly major part of culture.
Yeah, and you know what's really interesting? We talk about food all the time. Everybody does. It's on the news. It's in the advertising. It's in daily conversations. And unfortunately, and this is one of the reasons why I love what you guys are doing so much, we never often get to a place where it's a real conversation. And you guys are engaging me and other people in these conversations, which I think is incredibly valuable, and thank you. But the reason that we don't is that there's all kinds of social, like cultural stop signs that prevent us from actually having real conversations, which really show the power of food. So I used to teach a lot of cultural anthropology classes in addition to archaeology. And these classes would be very intro basic cultural anthropology classes. And we'd hit on all sorts of topics. We'd hit on religion and what makes up a family and sex and gender and all these things that are usually hot button items and people can get very upset about. But out of all those topics, the two topics that I found students in my classes having the most difficulty talking about were language and food.
Wow.
And it makes sense because, you know, in both of those things, everything that you are is wrapped, your identity is wrapped up in how you eat. Your identity is wrapped up in how you speak and how you communicate. And to have a real conversation, you need some people, if you don't set the context right, people can take it as an attack. People can take it as an affront. And, a great guy from Australia by the name of Marty Kendall wrote a paper recently called Agnostic Nutrition. And the idea that if we're really going to sit down and have a conversation about what can make us healthy, what's the healthiest diet for a human, then just for a minute, let's forget all the other cultural baggage. Like religion and how you eat as a result of that is incredibly important, and we're not denying that. Or socioeconomic status or politics, all these other things that influence how we eat and our food choices. But for a moment, let's just shed ourselves of all that baggage and have a real conversation about food, and then we can start to bring those things and feed them back in.
Precisely, I mean, it's about what we're bringing to, pardon the pun, bringing to the table, and how people are eating in context, because nobody's doing this, although some probably should be, and we can talk more about that as well, nobody's doing this out of context. Everyone has some connection to a person who's bringing them food, to a store that's bringing them food, to a hunter or a farmer's market that's bringing them food. So it's all about interactions that we're having, and I think the context in which we do those has dramatically shifted. I mean, we're no longer able to be as close to our food as we once was. So that could certainly be an issue. But I'm curious, why do you think people in this class struggled to talk about the food so much?
Well, again, because I think, you know, it's one of those things that both consciously and subconsciously we wrap all of our identity in. You know, and one thing I like to say, and I say it quite often when I speak, is I fully believe that every time we take a bite of food, choose a menu, an item on a menu in a restaurant, select something in a grocery store aisle and put it into our cart, every time we do that, we are expressing to the world ourselves, something about ourselves. Tradition, religion, family, you know, all socioeconomic status, political views, all of those things are wrapped up in our food choices, how we feed ourselves and how we feed our family. And the reverse is also true. If you say something against, you know, you shouldn't be eating this or you shouldn't be feeding your kids this way, it can be taken and considered as I'm doing something wrong and you're attacking something that's so incredibly important to how I view myself and how I view the world. You know, a great example in the, you know, in the 1970s, if you were listening to modern science and you wanted to be a good mother and raise a healthy child, you wouldn't breastfeed. Like, you're supposed to bottle feed your kids. Now, if you have a discussion like that right now with a mother that's 60 or 70 years old, then she may be automatically taking that as, oh my gosh, you're telling me I raised my kid the wrong way, you know, in one of the most important decisions that I could have made. And quite often get some pushback because of those sorts of things. But again, we're at a place now where we've never been more unhealthy as a species.
Right.
And we're doing creating it because of how we're eating. And we're killing ourselves and we're killing the planet. So it's the time that we actually really need to have those conversations more than ever.
I mean, that's what we love to do that. We're doing that here. We really think that a lot of other podcasts, a lot of other people just don't really dig deep enough into this stuff and give like highlights or
right. This is the tagline or, culture, the headline. Right. So how do we actually establish a basis of understanding what's possible, what's scientifically feasible, what's understood to actually be good for us and good for the world? Those decisions, I think most people feel they can't make. I think they feel out of the conversation. And part of what we've done as a society, at least in the Western world, is divorce people from the sourcing of their food, something we talk about pretty often here, so that they feel less likely that they'll be able to have an impact and they'll be able to make those choices themselves. They feel like they're sort of passively in this, and they will still make the choices. They'll still make those expressions. They'll feel like, oh, I'm getting this produce from this part of the grocery store versus this meat or this frozen dinner from this part of the grocery store, but you're still at the grocery store.
What a great point. And, you know, those things are so intentional. You make such an incredible point there. And it's actually part of the basis for much of what I'm doing now. You know, we are the only species on the planet that hires somebody to tell us how to eat. Yet we've never been more unhealthy as a species. And the only species that are as unhealthy as us because of how they eat are our pets and our livestock. And that's because we're doing the same thing in their food that we're doing to our own food. So something's wrong. And I need to make sure I say this the right way, but there is an incredible amount of information that we can learn through science and through nutrition science. And I hope that we continue to learn all of these wonderful things. But to rely solely on that, the information coming from, you know, the modern science and the modern nutritional science world is a huge mistake for a lot of reasons. And I'm not saying to disregard that information. I'm saying that we should think about it and use that information in conjunction with other incredible sources of information. And a basic way to understand that is other animals feed themselves healthy diets. They don't have to hire anybody else. They don't have to have nutritionists and scientists and lab coats and high-dollar machines or anything like that to do it. And they do a great job of it. We, on the other hand, are doing something incredibly wrong. And perhaps one of the most important pieces of all this is that the more that we rely on science and nutritionists and studies and this and machines to take our food apart and tell us exactly what's in it and all of this, every one of those steps takes power away from us to decide how we should be eating, right? You said to yourself, we don't feel like we can make those decisions about how to feed ourselves healthy diets. And it's because that power has been taken away from us. And it's only been in the past 120 something years that process has started. So much of that disempowerment has happened in 120 years. And, you know, when we used to look at food, we saw food. when we used to look at meat, we saw an animal. We used to look at liver, we saw an animal. We used to look at a plant, we know where the plant came from. And when we saw something on a table or sitting on a rock in front of us or coming off a fire to eat it, we saw it for what it was. But now we've fallen into that, what Michael Pollan calls nutritionism, right? This idea that we don't look at food, and we don't look at food and see food. We look at food and see a bunch of numbers and amounts of fat and calories and protein and micronutrients and macronutrients. And when we do that, we fall into this trap of thinking, oh my gosh, that's science and that's incredible, and I know more about my food than I ever did. But the reality is, you know less than you ever did. Other people have incredible machines that take this food apart and identify all these different components and the amounts of them. And that step alone disempowers us because we don't have access to those machines. And if we did, we wouldn't have to use them. But even more so, what's problematic is the result of making sense of that information. Even if that information comes out and is given to us, we don't know what it means because it's not in context.
Right.
A food having, you know, this much fat, this much protein, this much carbohydrates, this much gluten means absolutely nothing unless there's somebody out there telling us, hey, you know, the human, an average human should eat this many calories a day and consume this much fat a day and consume this much this and keep this out of their diet. And that right there, that mechanism gives incredible power to somebody else who we've never met and don't care at all about us. Mm-hmm. And that information can be used for advertising, for marketing, for making a heck of a lot of money at the expense of our health and the health of this planet. And that, I believe, is the key biggest problem right now in our dietary present. And that's why one of the things that I'm working so hard to do is to reconnect people to their food. And to do that, they need to reconnect to their past, what the diets were like in the past. They need to reconnect with their environment. They need to reconnect with their community, and they need to reconnect with themselves. And if we can make that reconnection happen, then people will be empowered to make their own decisions about how to eat.
That's really inspiring. That's one of the things when I first heard you speak that really spoke to me, especially because I have a master's in nutrition science, and I definitely, like, in the process of studying it, felt a lot of that reductionism, like that reductionist approach is so prevalent in nutrition science. And part of it is because, yeah, like just taking foods apart into their nutrients, that's what I mean by reductionist approach. And I am a scientist for sure at heart, but I've been recently really interested in getting to talk to and learn a lot from sort of social scientists, because I see this disconnect there. And I think food is a really, really important topic where I agree, we can't just focus on science as the only way to understand it. I really think that social and cultural perspectives to food are absolutely critical and an important part of the discussion that a lot of nutritionists, the way that they're taught maybe, does not consider that well enough. And the other thing you said that was interesting was just like that we hire someone to help us know how to eat. And I mean, I would extend this to like a lot of other things in our culture. I just think we're hiring people to do stuff for us in general. So that's sort of a little bit of a tangent, but maybe we're disempowered as a society, like in general more.
We're overconnected. That makes sense.
We're overconnected.
Right. In that we're using applications, services, hired hands, and the internet to give ourselves advice from every corner of the world without actually doing any of the research ourselves. Or we're feeling that the way the information comes down to us is indirect, right? And so what's happened here is people have not just lost sort of the power to feed themselves and do a lot of things for themselves, you know, do services that otherwise might be in their own hands. They've abdicated. They've actually given away that responsibility on purpose to gain some convenience, right? I mean, we spend less time on food than perhaps we ever have. And so it's interesting that we're also the least well-nourished nowadays. Because ancient peoples, if they had all of their technology and their culture centered around creating, killing, processing, transporting, storing their food, they had a much deeper, at least a much, you know, temporally, more temporally deep, a much longer duration sense of what everything was and how their lives were impacted by it. If we can go and pick something up really quickly or get something delivered to us, mm-hmm. we've lost that association. We're just losing how much time it takes to do the things that we now consider normal.
And there's so much lost with that idea of convenience. So the only thing I like to equate it to is when I was in graduate school and before we had Google and other sorts of things, and you could, you know, you wanted a reference and you could look it up and it's immediately right there in front of your face. When I used to have to go to the stacks in the library to get a book, mm-hmm. it was quite, more often than not that I went down to get a book and I ended up leaving with a different book that was next to it or two or three books down because I found myself in that section and all of a sudden reading all these titles and I lost myself in those stacks for 20 minutes or half an hour. And instead of taking one book, I'm walking out with 10 and I wouldn't have even known they were there. In fact, I've gone down there for a book and came back without that book because I found something better. But the other thing, I think a really good example of a powerful and unfortunate thing that we've lost with this sort of convenience, and is probably one of the larger topics right now that people are arguing about in the food world, is what's happened with packaged meat. Mm-hmm. You know, we have taken the face away in the idea of convenience and in the idea of not having to burden ourselves with even the thought of an animal dying to feed us. We have come, you know, we've created a situation where we expect to eat meat, and believe me, I truly believe the healthiest diet on the planet does include both animal and plant foods. Mm-hmm. But you go in and buy meat at the grocery store, and even though a lot of that meat is terrible meat, but it's packaged. We're grossed out if there's even the thought of seeing blood right somewhere in that package. That piece is packaged, taken off of that animal, and packaged in a way that you really, many people don't even know where on the animal it came from. Mm-hmm. And quite often you can go through that entire process of purchasing it, bringing it home, cooking it, and eating it. And never does the thought that an animal died cross your mind.
Right.
A lot of things have happened. And even in restaurants, I've been in a lot of commercial kitchens lately. They don't even use the word meat anymore. They don't say animal. They don't say meat. When they talk about that part of the plate, you know, that food, they say the word protein. And that's one, you know, what protein is going to be on the plate? Where's my protein for this plate? You know, that kind of language. And that kind of that language itself is just one more step away from an animal living, being raised a certain way, being killed a certain way, being taken apart a certain way, and being used in a certain way. And as we were sitting here, you know, in this cloud of convenience, right?
Yes.
All of the terrible things in the meat industry have been happening, you know, behind closed doors,
right,
behind our eyes, and outside of our conscious. You know, when we eat meat, for meat to, you know, the rules in our house, and I say rules. I mean, I have a family of three. I'm living in, you know, 2019, and we're in a, you know, in North America. So, you know, I say rules. We try to keep these rules. Every now and then, you know, we're living very busy, crazy lives. What we strive to do is if meat is good, the idea is if meat's going to come into our door, mm-hmm. we've either killed and butchered it ourselves, which is a large portion of the meat or animal products in our diet,
mm-hmm.
Or we know the person or family that raised or butchered that animal.
Mm-hmm.
And in turn, those people that are raising or butchering those animals know me and my entire family.
Wow.
To me, that is a connected, ethical, safe food system. In fact, the most connected, ethical, safe food system that there can be. So when I'm sitting down, I mean, think of the difference in, you know, somebody who went to the grocery store, picked up a packaged sirloin, came home, cooked it and ate it, maybe never even realizing that it came from a cow. And if they did, never even considering the life of that cow. And if they did, they would push that thought away with a shiver like, oh, my God, it's so bad to even think about that an animal was living. When we have food in our house, we're not only envisioning the experience of being in the woods to hunt it or the farm that it came from, but we're thinking about what that animal, and I know this sounds all tree-huggy and we're singing kumbaya, but it's real, right? We're sitting here thinking about that animal's life, and the fact that it died is an unfortunate thing, right? I've been hunting since I was 8 years old. I've never found pleasure in killing an animal in my life. But I find incredible pleasure and satisfaction and fulfillment in everything that happens from the moment that animal's dead to me nourishing my family with it, using the most of that animal, making it not only, you know, using in some cases upwards of 90% of that animal as food, but also doing it in a way that my family and anyone around me derives nourishment and pleasure. And I'm thinking about the life of that animal. And that is a system that, you know, if you're starting to work towards a sustainable food system, if we're not thinking about that consciously as we're eating an animal, then we're never going to reach it. We're never going to reach it.
Exactly. I mean, that is what humans did for so long, because that's what nature did. And the fact that that seems so alien to us, I mean, I can even feel myself thinking about that process. And it's not something I'm completely alien to. I've had hunted meat, and I certainly attempt to when possible. But the fact that we even feel this way reacting to it is because we now are so extracted from those processes, and we don't feel like those are our history, that those are natural to us. But that is more natural than the grocery store. And it's shocking how fast the transition happened, and just how much the human population has expanded to seemingly require that. Do you think there's an issue in, and this may or may not be a leading question, but do you think there's an issue in global food systems in being able to produce the quantity of food to feed billions, given the way that we now live in cities, given the way that we now have a massive population of billions instead of these sort of earlier smaller tribes, which did have, frankly, a lot more space?
Well, certainly there's first of all, let me directly answer the question quickly, and then I'll expand on it.
Sure.
I don't think there's an issue with feeding the population that's currently existing here or the growing population with the resources that we can make available. However, the approach has to change drastically. Right. Certainly, how, you know, and I will say, you make a very good point. When populations were a heck of a lot lower in the past, it was a lot easier to do, certainly. You know, I read a statistic the other day that said there are more people currently alive on this planet at this very moment than all the people that ever lived that are now dead put together.
Wow.
And I don't know if that's true or not, but even if it's partially true,
yeah,
and that's a lot of people to feed.
It's very, very close. Yeah, I think we might be finally at the point where we're sort of at parity, but it's shocking whether or not we're close or exceeding that, certainly. And it'll exceed
No matter where those numbers fall, it's still a lot of people compared to feeding a lot of people compared to in the past. But here's some of the issues. One of the issues are complete differences between how we choose to feed ourselves today and how we fed ourselves in the past, and some incredible lessons that we can take from that. So any evidence from the archaeological record and from living extant communities and the traditional communities in the world that I've either read or experienced by living with them myself, People naturally eat in these situations nose to tail. They eat literally the entire animal. So real quick, just for people listening, and I know we are so conditioned to thinking about what are the right foods to put into our mouths by what we see at the grocery store, but that is not what we should use as a frame of reference. Mm-hmm. You know, we modern Americans eat pretty much three animals, right? We eat pigs, cows, and chickens for the most part, unless it's Thanksgiving and we eat turkey. And we typically, those of us who are eating those animals, typically eat the same cuts all the time. Like we always, if you're eating, you know, many people who are trying to be healthy that are eating meat eat chicken breast. Like literally just eat chicken breast. And it blows my mind at how unnatural eating only three animals are, and more than that, what kind of an impact are you having on the environment if an entire animal is dying for you and you're eating one small piece of it over and over and over again, right? So number one, that's a really strange situation. Number two, even if you ate all the things that were available in the grocery store that came from those animals that you do choose to eat, you're only eating about half of that animal. Now, the current statistics, and they have been this way since the 40s, I believe, we eat in America, you know, Americans eat or have available in their grocery stores about 55% of a pig by weight and about 50% of a cow by weight. Mm. So by weight. So automatically half of that animal is not going into humans, but is either getting thrown away or used for other purposes, but not food to nourish humans, right?
Right.
So let's break that down. And number one, how does that compare to the past? Well, people in the past and still some groups in the world today eat upwards of 90-95% of an animal by weight. What does it mean nutritionally? Well, when we started adding meat into our diet about 3.5 million years ago, we didn't really add an incredible amount of nutrition compared to what we already had. Now, meat is much more nutrient dense than plants, right? Much more nutrient dense than fruits, much more nutrient dense than vegetables. But we don't see an incredible body and brain size jump when we start consuming meat. That jump doesn't occur until we start hunting. And the difference is that when we are scavenging an animal 3.5 million years ago on an African savanna that was killed by some nasty carnivore, what was left for us was the meat. The carnivore, and we see this now with carnivore feeding patterns, when a carnivore kills another animal, it kills it, jumps on it, rips it apart, and gets to the inside and eats all the organs and the blood and some of the fat and all this, and then runs off and goes to sleep for a little while to digest that incredibly nutritious, satiating meal, and then either comes back to finish the job or never comes back. But regardless, that dead animal that has been literally gutted is there for our ancestors to go in with basic stone tools and butcher and take some meat. That's exactly what we think was going on about 3.5 million years ago when meat was introduced to our diet. Hmm. But the most, and again, meat is more nutrient dense than vegetable food sources. But the most nutrient dense part of an animal is not the meat. In fact, the meat is the least nutrient dense part of an animal. It's the most nutrient dense part of the animal and most bioavailable. In other words, we, with our incredibly weak human digestive tracts, can eat it even raw and get almost all the nutrition it has from it without doing anything else to it, mm-hmm. are the guts and the blood and the fat. I mean, that right there is some of the most nutritious food on the planet. That is missing from our modern American grocery stores. So when I say we're not eating, when I say we're missing half of the animal, that's weight. We're missing more than half of the animal in nutrition. So we talk about feeding and sustaining this population or the growing population immediately with a mind shift, just approaching an animal differently. And now we have to change the way we raise them. We have to change the way we kill them. We have to change so many things. But let's just put that, the ethical stuff, aside for mm-hmm. just a moment.
Sure.
Nutritionally and on a sustainability level, if we shift the way we consume that animal, overnight we can more than double the food source that we have, and that food source is much richer in macro and micronutrients.
Wow. I mean, that is an antidote to a modern way of thinking. I think that even the scientific among us are pretty seduced by, which is saying we don't have enough. Look at the number of people, look at the habits we have. But this is the counter. This is exactly why it's about utilization. It's about how we treat what we have.
Yeah, and I think it's a great point about, I mean, being sort of in the science research side of food waste, and, you know, is a huge topic right now. And so that's a really interesting way of thinking about it that I don't think enough people are talking about. You know, food waste in terms of eating all parts of the animal is definitely not sort of, I don't know, at the forefront of people's minds. I mean, in general, I think I'm also really interested in just the idea of food waste, you know, and, you know, eating all parts of the animals is one approach to that I think would absolutely help. But I've recently been thinking a lot about, do we actually need to produce more food to feed everyone? And I don't think so. So I think food waste, you know, if we can reduce the amount of food waste, we don't actually need to produce more food to feed the world.
And you know, unfortunately, I 100% agree. And some of the food waste stuff we're doing sounds awesome, right? And waste in general sounds awesome. Mm-hmm. And it makes everybody that's doing it feel really good about themselves, but it isn't enough, right? It's not solving the problem. It's almost like, you know, you go to the farmer's market and you bring your little recycling bag and you buy a couple things to supplement your diet for the week, and you walked away thinking like you've made this major impact on the world. And what you've done is great, don't get me wrong. But
yeah,
my biggest fear right now is that we rest on these small little band-aids that we're doing and these small little steps. These small little steps are incredible, but there's so much more to do. So, you know, one, to get away from the animal part for just a second, but another, you know, incredible thing that we can do when we change our approach to food. Maize is the I believe for the past 2 years, is the most widely grown grain in the world, period, maize, corn.
Yeah.
And a large part of that certainly goes to animals, which it shouldn't, but it does. And a large part of it goes to biofuel and those sorts of things, which is fine. But a large part of it also goes into humans. And without getting into the weeds here, maize is probably the most difficult grain for our bodies to fully derive all the nutrition from. And, you know, maybe just one quick aside, and I probably should have started the whole thing with this, but the premise for everything that I do now is based on these two things that I believe to be true. One is that human beings, humans, Homo sapiens, are the weakest species on the planet, and as a result, have an incredibly difficult time getting resources from our environment without the advantage of technology. We create technologies to help us do all sorts of things and get raw materials from our environment to eat. But more importantly, and where these conversations really play are focused on, is that we have one of the least efficient digestive tracts of any animal on the planet. And if that's true, then we require that the assistance of technology to process food before we eat it to make it safe, nutrient dense, and bioavailable. So in fact, most, and we've created these technologies over 3.5 million years, and they do just that. They make food safe, nutrient dense, and bioavailable. And that's what our dietary past, if you remember one thing about our dietary past, I would say that's the most important thing to remember. And the obverse of that, to think about it the other way, is most of the foods that we as Homo sapiens consume, we have absolutely no biological business consuming.
Right.
Our digestive tracts are not made, are not built, or not designed to adequately break those foods down in a way that we can make the most of them. That doesn't mean we shouldn't eat them. What I'm saying here is that to base what we eat on the idea, well, should we be eating it or shouldn't we be eating it, is a silly argument that started to become silly 3.5 million years ago. We don't eat that way anymore. We're not running around on four legs, grabbing stuff with our hands, putting it in our mouth, and using our teeth and our digestive tracts to break it down. We require technology in almost every instance for everything that we eat. And that goes from animals to plants to dairy, all of it across the board. But we've built these bodies on these diets, so we need to keep that in mind. So with that said, maize is a grass, and seeds and grains are very difficult for our bodies to digest properly. Maize, I don't care if you grind it or bake it or boil it or steam it or what you do to it, unless you do one thing, and it's a process called nishtamalization, you will not release or make available all the nutrients in that maize to the human body. And again, a very quick version of a much longer story. Over the past almost 500 years, millions of people around the world have died from a disease called pellagra, which is a disease caused by a nutrient deficiency of niacin in the diet while eating massive quantities of maize, which has a large percentage of niacin in it. They died from a nutrient deficiency disease while eating massive amounts of a food that have that thing that they need in it. It was literally going into their mouth and passing directly through their bodies as they became sicker and sicker and eventually died. Mm-hmm. This nishtamalization process is a traditional Central and South American process to create real tortillas and real tamales and a bunch of other things. But a very small percentage of the world still nishtamalizes their maize. It's a very simple process. So why is that important here? Well, here you have the most widely grown grain in the world, a grain that is, you know, the staple in many starving people's diets around the world, and we are not doing one simple step to unlock all the nutrients to make them accessible to our bodies. I mean, that kind of conversation, that kind of thing is where the conversation needs to go to talk about sustainability and feeding a growing population and those sorts of things.
Yeah, that's really hits home for me because I'm doing some research on like the nutritional quality of crops in like developing countries. And I've had a lot of sort of ethical debates in my head sort of about should we be fortifying these foods when we could just, you know, change the way that the people are processing the food and sort of unlock the same levels of nutrients. And I think that's a really great example.
And, you know, the thing is that the problem is when you start fortifying things, somebody's making money, so there's momentum behind it. But when you're just trying to teach somebody to do a separate step on their own, right, nobody's making money on it. Or if you're asking the food industry to take that step, they're losing money on it, right? So we're fighting a really losing battle here unless we can connect people in a way that they realize the importance of it.
Right. And so the problem is essentially that we're suggesting here what goes counter to the existing commercial system. When you connect people more directly to food, you take out middlemen, you take out middle operators who are getting a percentage of that whole supply chain in profit. That's how this works.
Right. So, you know, I know one thing that is probably important to the people listening to this is, you know, we're talking about really cool stuff. We're talking about, you know, hunting and butchering your own animals and nishtamalizing maize and doing all these sorts of things. And some people might be listening thinking, hey, that's awesome. I'm doing it tomorrow. But a large number of people are saying, well, that's great, but I live in the middle of a city, or I'm a student and only have access to the dining hall, or I'm working two jobs and I only have so much time to actually cook. And I, you know, whatever. Whatever the barrier is, living a life where you can do all those things doesn't seem like it's really possible on a daily basis. And you know what? I would love everybody to do all these things as much as possible. But I don't think you need to take a really meaningful step. And what this is exactly what I'm suggesting. Take the foods that you eat every single day. And I don't care if it's peanut butter and jelly, or if it's, you know, whatever, omelets, waffles, pancakes, French fries, I don't care what it is. The foods that you eat every single day, because that right there is where you should take your first step. Because if you select a part of your diet that you eat once a month or once a week, you're not going to change anything, even if you completely transform it. You make a change, you make a significant, meaningful change by changing the things you eat every day, bread, mayonnaise, whatever. And then you take that and this is my suggestion. You make those things entirely, and I mean 100% from scratch at least once. And I don't care if you mess it up and you make something that your dog wouldn't even eat. The act of making something from scratch empowers you in a way that nothing else can. You even if you make, you know, if you make a long fermented sourdough sandwich bread and it's, you know, you've done that entire process, you will walk and you never do it again. You will walk into the grocery store with an entirely new set of eyes. At minimum, you've ripped down the veil that the advertising and the marketers and the food world has put up in front of you.
Right.
And you now know at minimum what you should be buying and who you should be supporting with your dollars and with your paycheck. And, you know, it isn't that hard. Making, you know, I made the decision several years ago to make every single food that my family eats 100% from scratch. And it lasted about a year. I was driving everybody around me nuts because it was insane. I mean, I'm talking about doing it in a way, and I don't know if this is the smartest way, but doing it in a way that nothing would look different from the outside. So in other words, my kids taking their lunch to school and they opened up their lunchbox, it looked like every other kid's lunchbox. It would have a sandwich, but everything was made from scratch. So I was making the mayonnaise and long fermented sourdough loaf bread. I was curing the meats. I was making the cheese. I was making all of it.
Wow.
And it was even, you know, I have a very flexible schedule as a professor, which I'm thankful for. But even with that, it was a lot to do.
Right.
So we then had to go back and say, okay, well, there's also a cultural health that we have to maintain as a family in addition to the biological health. So we then went back and there's certain things we will purchase now and then, but we do it in a different set of eyes. And I'm telling you, doing that, connecting with your food at that level is incredible. And you can see then your processed food through a different light. But I'll go back to that butchering thing in just a minute. You know, one of the most empowering things to do and visceral and basic and human is to butcher an animal for your meal. And, you know, many of us live in a small flat in Manhattan, or we live in a house over here, or we have somebody in our family that if we brought home, you know, it'd be impossible to bring home half a pig and lay it on the counter, right? For a number of different reasons. And if you can do that, great. If you can't, bring home a whole chicken. I mean, literally, bring home a whole chicken. The whole chicken has just about disappeared from the American grocery store, right? Bring home a whole chicken. You know the one that actually they put the neck and the hearts and the liver back inside, right? You have to actually pull that out. Your hand gets a little bit bloody. You start to take apart the chicken and you realize, A, this thing was once a living, walking animal. B, my gosh, there's so much similarity between the anatomy of even this bird and my own human anatomy. Mm-hmm. Take it apart, and you know, there's several. Not only do you get more connected that way, but you then also have three meals in one, right? You've bought this chicken, and now you not only can roast that chicken and eat that chicken, then have leftover meat you put in a sandwich, and then take the bones and you make the stock, and you do this with the skin, and you keep the fat on the side by the stove and eat that. You've accomplished so many things just by butchering. Now the third thing I would suggest too is not only. It has to do with sourcing your food. And it's not only meeting the farmers at the farmer's market or going to the farms where the animals are raised and meeting your butcher. Those things are very, very important. But I also would suggest, and this may sound very strange, but just like with the cooking from scratch, you don't have to do it every day.
Right.
Do it seasonally, maybe even at minimum. Go get the food yourself. Forage, fish. If you have the ability, go and hunt. Even if you don't bring anything home, the act of doing it connects you with the food in a really important way. It's hyper-seasonal by default, gets you outside by default, and it puts, which I think also really cool, the responsibility in your hands, right? If you do it right, you nourish your family. If you do it wrong, you anger your family. And if you do it really wrong, you kill somebody. No, you don't kill somebody. You got to be very careful. But, you know, that, again, just – fishing. How many people actually fish anymore? And if they do, they're releasing that fish. Listen, this is going to make a lot of people angry. I don't get the catch and release thing. Like, I have no, again, I don't like killing anything, but killing an animal and then using it to nourish my family sits extremely well with me. I love that. It's an important component of my life. Hooking an animal, putting it through complete hell, pulling it out of the water, taking a picture for our amusement, and then putting it back into the water, there's something incredibly wrong with that to me. Yeah. And in fact, most of the catch and release fish that we release end up dying anyhow. So go out, catch something, bring it home, make a meal out of it. Go out, simple foraging. You don't even have to leave your yard. There are edible plants in your yard that are more nutritious than the things in the grocery store. Mm-hmm. Taking those steps are the steps that I'm suggesting for reconnecting with your food.
That makes perfect sense, and what this is a prescription for every different type of person to approach this differently, which I think is perfect. We have to couch it in those terms and say, if you are a vegan, that means start your own garden. If you are a hunter, that means hunt your own meat. If you want to do things that make sense to you, there is always an option. This is not a prescription for what everyone is being forced to do, but it's how everyone can do something. And that's really critical. If we don't start making these choices, they're going to keep being made for us. And just respond to something like catch and release fishing. Well, there are already two things at play there. One, most people probably don't want to do the fish butchery required to eat that fish. Or the fish stocks have already been so depleted by industrial fishing that in these situations, they're just responding to local laws and legislation that is trying to protect one more natural resource we've misused.
Well, that's a really good point, but I would counter and say that it is the industrial fishing that caused the issue, not the recreational father and son or mother and daughter out at the pond.
Oh, yeah, sorry, no, that's what I was implying. Yeah.
No, but you're absolutely right. Yeah. And I would also say whether or not it's thinking about whether or not you should be fishing or foraging or whether it makes sense to do that or even choosing what foods you should be eating, like literally what foods to include in your diet. A suggestion that I have, and I think it's very important, it's very empowering, is question everything. There is nothing that we've been told that we shouldn't question. And I don't care who said it to you. I don't care if it was a friend, a parent, a doctor, a nutritionist, somebody you hate, somebody you don't agree with. Question every single thing that you've been told. Now, you probably come back and realize that many of those things were absolutely true. But, you know, we're at a place now, and the more that I learn, and I know we're running out of time, but, you know, the more that I learn about things like oxalates in plants and plant toxins, you know, certain foods that I would have never questioned as in terms of their nutritional and safe ability, things like spinach or Swiss chard or kale, and we put some of these foods up on a pedestal and we don't even touch them. So, you know, if you've never thought about fishing, think about fishing. If you've never thought about foraging, at least consider it. if you've never considered that some of the foods in your diet that your mother or grandmother have fed you your entire life might be healthy or unhealthy, question it. Yeah. And this is, you know, empower yourself to make your own decisions and put all of this into your own hands.
That's for sure Noah's opinion. And now my opinion. When I met Noah, that's what he told me. That's his, like, philosophy also just on life, you know, question everything. Always be open to learning and be open to knowing that, you know, what someone told you, no matter what their expertise is, that you might be wrong or they might be wrong. And I, you know, that I think is how we try to live and try to look at stuff.
I want to just spend 10 seconds going back to the fact that we are all here full supporters of modern science. But I think we are skeptics of modern capitalism and its impacts on global food systems and on human thought. I think we need to let absolutely science do its thing. We've got way, way, way better infant mortality than the ancient world did, even though they perhaps were on average much less obese, right? So there are many things that we've done correctly, and I think that a certain audience member could hear all of this and say, well, we're rejecting something of science, and we aren't. We're taking the best knowledge we can from both eras or from all three eras, right? We're trying to create a future that's responding to what we know from the past, right?
You know, that's incredibly well said, and I 100% agree. There's a lot of people in the ancestral health community that would suggest that all of the answers lie in the past. And I think there's incredible answers that lie in the past. In fact, most of my focus is on what's happening in the past. But first of all, I don't care when you were in the past, you didn't have it 100% right. You didn't have it the best that it could be. But you had it really, really good because we're here to talk about it. Mm-hmm. But and I believe you had it better in the past than we have at this very moment.
Right.
But it wasn't the best. We can always improve upon it. You know, the idea that we have always in the past developed technologies or approaches to food that took us one step further. We could get more nutrition out of it. We could get safer nutrition out of it. We could get more bioavailable nutrition out of it. You know, that process doesn't have to stop. And it doesn't artificially stop at the agricultural revolution where a lot of people believe everything went to hell. Well, some stuff did go to hell, but it doesn't stop there. The best thing that we can do to sort of forge and pave a way forward for diet and health and sustainability is to take the best of the past as a platform. And then start, you know, once we're there, and we're not there yet, once we've done that, then we can take modern science, modern nutrition, and fuse those two things together to make the healthiest population and the healthiest planet that we've ever seen.
Absolutely. We couldn't agree more. It's a synthesis of knowledge, and it's doing what each person can, because not everyone can do everything, but that's okay. There are specialists. There have always been specialists, right? There's always someone back at the village who was fletching arrows instead of actually throwing the spears that got them dinner. And that's perfectly normal. It's not incompatible with what we're talking about here. So just want everyone to remember, it's okay to be the arrow maker. It's just about being in a society that still values its food and its people.
100%. You know what? And I truly believe... But one of the differences is today people don't see the arrow maker.
Right.
Like, they don't have to be the arrow maker, but they at least saw the arrow maker and saw what that person was doing and was connected with it that way. So that's, you know, everybody doesn't have to make all their food from scratch. Everybody doesn't have to cook 100% and forage all the time. But I do think the only way that we can empower ourselves to the place that we can overcome, you know, this sort of absence of knowledge and absence of connection that we have and allow the capitalistic interests to impact our health and the health of our planet is to take those things back, to understand them again. So, you know, you make a loaf, go right now and make a loaf of sourdough bread. At least do it once.
Oh, yeah.
And it will change your life.
Oh, yeah. We've done that.
Yeah. We don't, we're trying to cook more. But when we do, we don't cook all that much. But when we do, we try to make stuff totally from scratch.
Absolutely. We have a sourdough starter, and we've had many before. It's the way to do it.
And it, awesome. It does. It makes you feel empowered. It makes you feel connected. I definitely don't think I grew up feeling connected to my food, right? And I think that's the problem. And
almost nobody does.
Right. But I mean, maybe some people, you know, grew up on farms or, you know, just a little closer to nature might, but I think, yeah, in general, I'm absolutely like the average person. I just one other topic, like last topic that kind of wanted to bring up. We, you know, we do love sort of modern science and modern technology, and I think there's a lot of issues with the way modern technology and science is implemented. Yeah, and as we said, maybe, you know, due to sort of the like capitalism or sort of the societal values that we have. I'm just really interested in how maybe you think we could, do you think we should keep making new technologies? Because you think technologies were a really important part of our ancestral past in terms of getting the nutrients and things from food and being able to digest things. So do you think there's like a role for more science and technology advancement in terms of food?
I certainly do. But I think we've sort of, we've gotten to a place where even the people, even the scientists who are doing these things with food, maybe don't always appreciate or understand the earlier approaches to food. You know,
sure.
Most, I'm for convinced sure. Most of the earlier approaches to food were focused on, like I said earlier, making food safe, nutrient dense, and bioavailable.
Yeah.
We are now processing our food at the expense of nutrients, at the expense of safety, at the expense of our ability to absorb those the nutrient bioavailability of the foods. And we're doing it for reasons that have to do with money, right? Shipping and shelf life and these sorts of things.
Right.
So
and convenience also.
And convenience.
Right.
And if you're doing that, you're doing it in a vacuum. I have no problem with science trying to figure out how something can last longer on a shelf, but I don't want them to try to figure that out at the expense of the nutrients, right? I don't want people sitting there and producing food that is so nutrient-free, but tweaking all of my evolutionary senses and needs and desires so that I want to eat more and more and more of this food that has absolutely no nutrition in it. Like, I have no interest in that whatsoever. But, you know, if what I'm suggesting, and I don't even know how we get there in the sort of science and nutrition food world, right? I have some ideas about how, and I've shared some of them, how we as regular people deal with food in our own lives and in our families' lives. But at a higher level, I wish we could just stop, back up, do things the way we used to do them, and then start implementing science to do that those things even better, right? So, and again, I don't know how we should do that, but I at least think the focus of modern food science should be on safety, nutrient density, and bioavailability. And if we focus on that, then we would only be doing good.
We couldn't agree more. And we know that there's still work to be done, and that there's nothing incompatible about doing that work with having a good evolutionarily sensible diet, right? There's nothing incompatible about continuing to make better systems to deliver foods that made sense long ago, and technologies that worked for people for millions of years. We have the knowledge that we need to get those projects started. We just have these competing forces that are sort of distracting us from what could possibly be done.
And I just also think in general, in research and academia, being sort of in that world, we get into these like silos, you know, and we tend to think that our lens, the lens through which we look at something, is the correct lens, or maybe just in general, you know, humans do that. But
right.
That's why I think these kinds of conversations are so important, and that we need to sort of work with other people, you know, do interdisciplinary work, and more than that, though, just like really, I don't know, talk to these people and really empathize with different perspectives on things.
I couldn't agree more, 100%.
What I'm just trying to say, like, scientists probably don't, like, they don't have, like, any training, or they don't really think about things from the past, you know? I don't think that that's, like, the way that their mind, like, their training has taught them to think. But I think, yeah, you can lose a lot from not acknowledging, just in general, you can lose a lot from not acknowledging the past when you're trying to make a better future.
I couldn't agree more. And one of the, you know, somebody asked me the other day, I was being interviewed for a podcast, and they asked me I wish I had been born in a different time period. Like, was I born, do I think I was born 40,000 years too late? You know, that sort of thing. And I said, no. And are you happy living in the time period you're living in? And I said, you know, I do have these sort of romantic thoughts about, you know, living past or whatever, but to be 100% honest, this is the perfect time to be living right now. Right. You know, our diets, health of our species and our planet has never before been more screwed up, but we've also never before been engaged in the kind of conversation that we're having now around all of these issues. And part of it is the ability, you know, podcasts like yours, social media, we've never before been able to all of us engage in the same conversation. We just have to make sure that conversation is meaningful. Mm-hmm. But I think we're poised now to make the best decisions that we could ever make as a species. We just have to get over ourselves, but we can definitely do it. And the only way we can do it is to engage all those people. We need scientists, we need nutritionists, we need doctors, we need anthropologists, we need sociologists, we need all, and parents, you know, all of these people in the same conversation, and we can make the changes that we need that are going to be the meaningful changes.
Thank you so much.
Couldn't agree more, and we seriously appreciate you joining us and helping to educate all of us and bring these conversations to the forefront. This is the first step in doing something. So anyone listening at home, if you feel you haven't had an impact, you have. You've just listened to all of this and begun to think about how to properly change these systems and to incorporate strategies from the best parts of human existence, past and present and future, into modern life. That's all about. So thank you, Bill, for joining us.
Well, fantastic. It's been my pleasure.
Before we go, where can everyone find you online?
Oh, fantastic. So my website is drbillschindler.com. So drbillschindler.com. I'm on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Dr. Bill Schindler, spelled the same way. If you want to see some of the work that I'm doing at Washington College, then look up ES Food Lab. We'll follow us on social media, ES Food Lab, for the Eastern Shore Food Lab. And then finally, my work directly related to empowering people to take back control over their diet and connecting them to their food. You can find that information at The Modern Stone Age Family.
Awesome.
Fantastic. We'll put all those links in the description. And once again, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you.